I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. That gleaming copper dome in Topeka is a staple of Kansas culture, but it hasn't always been so pretty. In 2000, the state Senate president pushed through a multi-million dollar renovation project that restored that shiny state capitol. That dome is only a piece of Dick Bond's 60-year legacy in Kansas. Today, he reviews his years in office and discusses what's happening these days under that dome. Then, the Kansas City area holds a few Guinness records, including loudest crowd roar and oldest cinema. Soon we might add another, largest tuba ensemble. We'll find out who the mastermind is behind this big brass gathering. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Dick Bond is one of those mainstays in a community who's done so many things that you can hardly keep track of them all. From reading Christmas Eve scripture at his Rolling Hill Presbyterian Church to serving as president of the state Senate in Topeka or chairman of the Kansas Board of Regents to his work as a banker and on too many boards to mention, Bond's presence has been felt around here for a long time. In fact, for a time he was a kingmaker in Topeka, virtually anointing Bill Gray's Republican nomination for governor back in 1994. More recently, he's been a leader of the Republican moderate opposition to conservative Republicans like Sam Brownback and Chris Kobach. So it's time for a conversation with a longtime Kansas leader. Dick, welcome. So nice to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be with you.
I'm sure you've met President George H.W. Bush any number of times.
Yes, I had the pleasure to meet him when he was a freshman congressman. He was a close friend of my boss, Larry Wynn.
Back in the 1960s.
That's right. In 1968, we had him here for Wynn's first reelection. Huh. And that's when I first met George H.W. and then met him a number of times, including after he was elected and with Barbara and in fact, Sue and I were invited to an event at the Martin Luther King Library in Washington, D.C. There were like 40 or 50 of us, and Barbara brought out her new book, ostensibly written by her dog.
That's right, Millie, right?
That's right. It was Millie's book, and it was written to be a fundraiser for literacy.
Mm-hmm.
And but they were wonderful people.
A class act, like everyone is saying.
They really were.
Today. Yeah. We'll talk politics in a bit here, but one thing I wanted to ask you about is the newly restored Kansas State House. Today, it's a showcase. When I first started over there in the late 1980s, it wasn't, and that's putting it nicely. You were the architect, or at least one of them, for finding a way to pay for a restoration project that wound up totaling something like $350 million. That project wouldn't have happened if you hadn't found the money to get it done. Where did you find the money?
mirrors and smoke and
couch cushions. Yeah.
But it was a serious issue, Steve. I had an architect look at the building when I became president. And he said, you know, if there's a fire starts on the first floor and you're on the fifth floor, you have 5 minutes to live.
Wow. Wow.
Because it all, through that rotunda, the smoke would just go up to the top floor first, and then on down. We had nothing, no alarms, no sprinkler system.
Wow.
We had pieces of the building falling off on the people walking below. Hmm. It was a very serious and dangerous thing. And so I attempted to get leadership, including Graves.
The governor at the time.
Right. And the House leadership to join in. And so I got three airplanes, and we went to Minnesota, Iowa, and Ohio, all of whom had done restoration, to see how they did it. And really, we kind of started suiting people up, both parties. I took took Republicans and Democrats, and had it, getting the money was tough. I'll never forget, I had a press conference just as I was leaving office after 4 years of being president, and I said, I'm afraid this project may go as high as $150 million.
You're off by a little bit.
It was $330 million project, but it's gorgeous, beautiful.
It is gorgeous.
And it's a showcase in the nation.
You got the money where then?
We have bonds. We were getting money from the treasurer off of idle funds. And I had a lot of help from my then and later president, Dave Kerr. Dave was chairman of Ways and Means.
He knows finances.
And he knows finance. And he, when he signed off, I knew everybody will follow.
How tough of a sell was it for at least some members of the legislature to sign off on a project that you really didn't know how much it was going to cost?
Well, everybody saw how deteriorated the building was. It was ugly.
It was.
And the offices were horrible. There wasn't anything pretty about it.
There used to be a snack bar, Don's Snack Bar, down on the first floor, just down from our office. And I remember walking in the building for the first time, and they built grill hamburgers there, and it would smell over the rotunda, and you used to wonder, what's going on here?
Yeah. So. Well, I remember you, Steve, when you came up there as a rookie.
A rookie.
Uh-huh.
A little wet behind the ears.
And you really made an impression on an awful lot of us, because you never, unlike some of your colleagues, played the gotcha game that try to catch you in something. And that's what it seemed to me many of the journalists, political journalists, were trying to do. You never did that. And that's the reason you left that job with high respect.
Well, you're nice to say that. My colleague was John Peterson, who became a much older man than me, much older. But I'm joking, John, if you're listening, but a great guy and became a great friend.
He was. John was a class act.
Class act, absolutely. Well, you know, there are lots of ways to define legacy. Is the State House, Dick, is that ultimately yours? Is it number one on the list?
No. No, I would say probably the difference-making things that I've done relate to raising money for children's issues. And that would be multiple children's issues, including KVC, behavioral issues for children. And started raising money for them, golly, 30 years ago, probably. Mm-hmm. And you can make a real difference in people's lives, in children's lives. And more recently, it's been fun to be involved with the Shawnee Mission Hospital's Infant Development Center, Leanne Britton Infant Development Center. And we just announced the completion of a $20 million campaign that's going up, and will be open probably in the spring, and for children with all kinds of issues like autism, Down syndrome, developmental disabilities. That's a real difference, Steve. You can make a difference in people's lives, and that's what really makes you feel good.
So you don't hesitate, you don't mind asking people for money?
No, I don't. I don't have a problem asking people for money when I believe in the cause. And I believe in the cause when you're talking about children, and especially with children with disabilities, whether it's behavioral or whether it's from birth.
What's the key to making an effective ask for money?
You think you honestly tell your story, and it's helpful if you can get somebody that'll give a reasonable amount of money and take them with you and say, okay, here's Charlie. And Charlie's with me today because he's giving 50,000, a million, whatever the number is. And it impresses the donor, the foundation, to believe they're not in this alone.
Mm-hmm.
There are others. Foundations don't want to be the first.
Right, right. But once you get it started, there you go.
When you get it started, then all of a sudden they say, oh, include us. This must be a good deal. Somebody has really researched the quality of these of this organization.
Dick Bond, a former president of the Kansas Senate, is my guest. You know, Dick, you came of age as a Republican moderate in an era when conservatives were largely regarded as outcasts of one kind or another.
Right.
That changed in this state back in the 1990s, and I'm wondering, why do you think that happened? Why did the Republican brand take on such a dramatically different hue over the years?
Well, I'm not sure I can have a clear answer for that, but certainly the change in American politics, I would say there's at least three issues. One is the evangelicals,
mm-hmm.
that have and changed the deep Democratic South to a Republican stronghold.
Right.
And evangelical ministers led that along with the abortion issue.
Mm-hmm.
And abortion's been very powerful, especially in the South.
And in Kansas.
In Kansas as well. And then nationally, the Citizens United case before the U.S. Supreme Court has radically changed American politics and state politics.
Because so many people can give anonymously now.
You can give without attribution as much as you want. No one ever finds out about it. And it's a tragedy.
Yeah. How hard was all this for you to watch, Dick, as you saw the state change, transform?
Well, it would have been very hard if I had been president of the Senate or in the Senate, but I retired just as the far right was beginning to make small inroads into the Kansas Senate. And there were a few. Tim Huell's camp was mm-hmm. there, who went on to
the
be
Congress, yeah.
Congress, far right, one of the farthest right members of the U.S. Congress.
Todd Tiert, I think, was a seatmate of yours, if I recall correctly, when he first came, a former congressman from Wichita.
Yes, he was. Todd Tiert sat next to me. My job was to try to calm him down.
When I say the name, then, Sam Brownback, you think what?
Well, you know, I knew Sam when he was a moderate Republican, when he was pro-choice. And Sam ran for Congress in the second district,
mm-hmm.
and he had all the money in the world because he married in the Stauffer family, and he almost got beat by an unknown from some little town in the second district based on abortion,
mm-hmm.
and. I don't know his motivation, but he quickly changed,
mm-hmm.
and he became more and more conservative. Then, of course, he became Opus Dei. Then he ran for governor,
right.
coming from the U.S. Senate, which is amazing. Why would you leave the U.S. Senate, the most prestigious group in the world, to be governor of Kansas? But I think he thought he needed administrative experience in order to be president of the United States. And so he came back to get his administrative experience, and he made a lot of mistakes, but one of which was saying somewhere that this his tax cuts were an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And that experiment term took him down.
When I mention the name Kris Kobach, you say what?
Well, Kris is a tough guy. He's very obviously very bright. Harvard, Yale, Oxford,
right.
kind of like your background, Steve.
Yeah, I wish. Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but he's a tough guy. He's not warm and fuzzy. He had money because he selected a running mate who put in, what, like $1.5 million?
Wayne Cartman,
or
right.
more, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But Chris never could raise money very well.
Mm-mm.
And he was not well organized in his campaign. And then he did such outlandish things like appearing in parades with a machine gun on the back of a Jeep. It was just like, I'll show you. Mm-hmm. Just stick it in your face. He's a hard man.
You know, you've made it something of a habit the last few years to cross the partisan divide. As a Republican, you've stepped forward publicly to back Democratic candidates. Paul Davis, who ran for governor against Brown back in 2014, then this year with Laura Kelly against Kris Kobach. How tough was that for you to do?
Not tough at all.
Hmm. After a lifelong membership in the GOP.
Yeah, when I became president of the Senate, the second day I was president, I went over to the minority leader's office, Tony Hensley, and said, what's going on, and just to be friendly. And he said, what are you doing here?
Hmm.
He said, we've never had a president of the Senate come to this office.
Huh.
I said, well, you better get used to me. Because I'm going to be here unless you throw me out. And he didn't throw me out and would have me over from time to time to explain some big legislative issue to his caucus. And I think if you're going to have reasonable government, you've got to reach across the line. When the Republicans got so, in my view, crazy with the conservatism, with Brownback and others, it was easy for me to support moderate candidates like Paul Davis and like Laura Kelly. Laura Kelly's a really class act, mm-hmm. and I think she's going to make a big difference. It's going to be extra hard for her to get things done, and she's going to have to go to grassroots to get it done, especially like Medicaid expansion, highways, and some increased funding for schools.
Do you have any feel, can she get something like Medicaid expansion done, Dick?
I think she can.
Mm-hmm.
And how you have to do that is you go to every little town that's got a hospital or a clinic, and you get their chamber, you get their farm bureau, you get people from each of those little towns come up and beat on their legislators, their senator and their house member, and say, we've got to have this to mm-hmm. save mm-hmm. our hospital. Because they're going to go under. Absent increased Medicaid expansion, they're going under, and we've already had two or three go under. So, and you can do the same thing with highways.
Yeah.
And I think you can do the same thing with schools. But she's going to have outside help.
Dick Bond, the leading Kansas moderate, is my guest. How did a kid from KCK wind up as a banker, wind up in the political world to begin with?
Well, I lie a lot because
that helps in that world. Yeah.
I was born in Kansas City, Kansas, mm-hmm. but my parents moved me as an infant to Mission, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell everyone in Wyandotte County I'm one of them, and everybody in Johnson County, I'm one of them.
It broadens the base. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's been helpful at times.
Yeah.
But
why politics for you?
Well, I didn't really mean to go into politics. When I was in law school, I got a job my third year in law school in a law firm in Lawrence, Asher Ellsworth and Six, and they needed some rummy in there to do errands and stuff, and so, because Ellsworth was out a lot because he was running for Congress from Douglas County against a Democrat incumbent from Wyandotte County.
Hmm.
That was an era when the Democrats in Wyandotte County had some clout. The population in Wyandotte County was big, and Johnson County was just beginning to grow post-World War II,
uh-huh.
J.C. Nichols, Crow Brothers, mm-hmm. all that stuff. And so when I graduated, Ellsworth wanted me to help him in Johnson County because that was strange territory and lots of new people in those new subdivisions. And so that's how I got started. And the county attorney, a guy named Hugh Kramer, asked me to be his assistant. So I really went back to Johnson County to be the assistant county attorney.
So you ended up working for three members of Congress,
right,
you said?
Right, three members of Congress, Bob Ellsworth, Larry Wynn, and then very briefly, Jan Myers.
But why didn't you run yourself? Because you were urged to at one point. They wanted you to.
Oh, I know. And I always felt I could win. When Larry Wynn stepped down, Sue and I went down to, my wife went down to Puerto Vallarta, took a yellow pad, and we wrote down all the reasons to run. And the reasons to run were, it's good for your ego. Mm-hmm. My grandkids could say, Grandpa was somebody. And the third reason was, we can win. Because
mm-hmm.
I had everybody that gave money to win was going to give money to me.
Sure.
A whole bunch of people, including several Democrats, say, if you run, we won't run. And I got to think, we wrote on the other part of that yellow pad, reasons to not run, mm-hmm. like maybe we ought to try to make some money. maybe we don't have to do what everybody thinks we ought to do.
Yeah.
Even though we can win. So anyway, I went and became chairman of the board of a bank and in a law firm with Bob Bennett. And then all of a sudden came the state Senate.
Mm-hmm. Why banking?
Invited. I was invited to be on the board of a bank, and mm-hmm. I liked it. And it's a people business, mm-hmm. and that's me.
You know, just a couple more things. When you were in the Senate, you told me once, as you were getting ready to leave, that maybe one of your biggest disappointments was not having done more for K-12 education. When you had the Republican governor in place, like a Bill Graves, your leadership in the Senate, what happened there? And why was that a disappointment for you?
Well, not only for K-12, but also for higher education.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure. I think the mindset of Republicans, even moderate Republicans, were now let's don't overspend, let's be prudent. And so we didn't do as much as we could have. But we didn't starve them to death either.
Mm-hmm. But it was an opportunity to hit a home run.
It was an opportunity, but you can never fund schools enough. Clearly, we've been underfunding and still are underfunding schools. But when I left there, we were K-12 was not in bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
We were very, I think, careful and generous.
Mm-hmm. You're a former chairman of the Kansas Board of Regents. What's the state of higher education in Kansas today, Dick?
State of higher education in Kansas is that it's being starved to death.
Hmm.
The Brownback years of tax cuts have really hurt all six of our Regents institutions. Our community colleges have the benefit of a local ad valorem tax.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't suffer as long as they can just increase taxes themselves. But the six universities, KU, K-State, Wichita, Pittsburgh, Emporia, and Hayes, all depend on the legislature. And we got another problem in higher ed, especially when the economy's going well. Population at the universities goes down.
Mm-hmm.
Enrollment goes down. Enrollment goes up when it's bad times because people want to get more education to get a job. But our enrollment almost everywhere is going down. KU Med is helping KU overall, and KU Edwards is helping KU overall. But I don't know what K-State's lost 1,000 like last year, and it's happening all over. MU lost what 7,000.
Your message would be what as you look on the scene today?
I think we cannot rely on tuition as the main source of revenue for our schools because we have really priced out low-income people. And we're beginning to price out middle-income people from higher ed. And that's wrong.
Right. That's Dick Bond, former president of a Kansas State Senate. Dick, it's been great to have you here. Thanks for taking us a walk down, looking back at some things.
Sure, appreciate it. Great to be your friend.
Thanks, Dick. I really appreciate that. And you have been. I appreciate it. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the link between tubas, the Guinness Book of World Records, and Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, Kansas City's newest memorial is the first of its kind in the state. It commemorates Levi Harrington, a victim of a lynching back in 1882. You can hear about that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Peter Sagal, humorist, writer, and host of the NPR game show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He discusses his midlife crisis turned lifelong love, and that's running. Kansas City is going after a world record this weekend, it would certainly qualify as a little offbeat. Kansas City's 11th annual Tuba Christmas will attempt to set a Guinness Book of World Records for largest tuba ensemble. The attempt will take place downtown on Friday. Tuba players are still being sought, and here to talk about this is Frank Byrne, executive director of the Kansas City Symphony and a tuba player himself. Frank, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve.
Whose idea was this to go for a world record here, Frank?
Well, can we first put on the record that what we are trying to do tomorrow is entirely insane?
Yes, that's for sure.
Well, just a little history about Tuba Christmas. It started in 1974. Mm-hmm. The original idea was to honor the memory of William J. Bell, who was a very famous tuba teacher. He was born on Christmas Day. His principal student, Harvey Phillips, who is a native of Aurora, Missouri.
You know all these things this history,
yep.
Yes.
Organized the first one in New York City in December of 1974. Tuba Christmas has been in Kansas City since 1981, but the symphony has hosted it since 2008. Now, we've had real success with it, and so many people want to play that we've had to split it into 2 days at the Kauffman Center, and we've had around 700 players.
There's 700 players in the Midwest from the Kansas City area to come do this?
Yes, and they come from all over, but yeah.
Who are these people?
It's everything from kids to people that have been playing for decades.
Yeah.
But here's the deal. We have a very generous donor by the name of Don Flora. He plays the tuba, loves this event, and he asked me one day, what would it take to set the world record? So,
why not? Right?
Yeah, why not? Yeah. That's right. We contacted Guinness World Records, and we have been through all the wickets, and it's extremely specific. How
it's
you
not
have to
easy
do it.
To do this, right?
No, yeah. No. I mean, there are many criteria you have to satisfy in order to be certified. And so we have a Guinness adjudicator coming into town to do all this for us. And the standing world record was set in 2007. And that was for 502 players. Huh. So we know that we have regularly beat that. But tomorrow we are expecting not just to beat it by a little bit, but to smash it.
How many are you expecting tomorrow? Are you willing to say yet? Or?
Well, I'll tell you how many are registered as of this morning.
Okay.
Would you like to take a guess?
700.
972.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Are they coming from all over the country, all over the world?
All over the Midwest. But, you know, principally in this region.
How did you get the word out to tuba players, which is such a thin slice of the population, Frank?
Well, of course, we went to educators. This is a big deal for school groups to come, both at the high school and middle school and university level. So, of course, we did that. And we have a database of people that have come in the 10 previous years that we've hosted it. So we can communicate with them. We, of course, put it out on social media, and we were pretty quiet for a while about the fact that we were going to go for a world record. We just told people, you know, it's going to be on one day because we've done it on 2 days in the past. Uh-huh. And then when we started talking about the world record, people just kept coming and kept coming. not only do we have 972 players pre-registered, and there may be some walk-in, but the audience who are coming We have over 7,000 people who are scheduled to who have signed up to come and hear the concert at noon.
This is going to be at noon tomorrow at Municipal Auditorium
downtown, right? That's
and if folks still want to participate, meaning what's the word for tuba player? Tubist. If tubists want to play, they can register by going to the Kansas City Symphony's website to take part. What's going to happen at this event tomorrow at noon? What will people see?
Well, they will see the whole floor of the Municipal Auditorium filled with players. We've already got the chairs set up.
You're one of them, right?
Yeah. But we've got the chairs set up. It's going to be literally practically wall to wall in the long side of the arena. And, you know, we will get together. We will have a great time. We will play Christmas music as we've done every year. But we will take a special moment in time to meet the criteria to have set the world record. And there's criteria around that, but we will do that. We will also give the world premiere of a new piece composed for the event tomorrow by Jim Barnes, who was for many years a professor of composition at KU.
Wow.
And he's written a piece that he will conduct tomorrow. So we're just out to have fun, make it special, and smash that world record.
And to be clear, the public is welcome. The event is free for
Absolutely.
Them. If folks want to flow into
Absolutely.
Municipal Auditorium downtown,
yeah.
they can come witness the making of a world record.
Absolutely. And the concert begins at noon, so we would ask you to be in your seats by noon. If you go onto the Kansas City Symphony website, go to the calendar, look at December 7th, and click on it, you'll see one of the options for tomorrow is Tuba Christmas. Click on there, and it'll show you how to pre-register. It's free. We're just trying to get an idea of how many people are coming.
Yeah.
But you can just show up. I mean, we're not going to turn anyone away tomorrow.
Well, let's give folks a little sense of what it's going to sound like, a little more sense. This is Adeste Fidelis.
Yeah.
And
O Come All Ye Faithful.
O Come All Ye Faithful. Here we go. Gather that's from a previous Tuba Christmas.
It is. And, you know, I have to say that is only about 350 players.
Well, there's something just to witness that sound in public has got to be kind of extraordinary.
Yes, it is. Let's just say that it's an experience. But I've never heard 900 plus players myself. So take what you just heard and imagine it times three. And so it's going to be really interesting.
There's a sense of solemnity, if that's the word, that tuba brings to the table here.
Well, let's just say that, you know, the tuba is an instrument of which there is one in an orchestra and, you know, several in a concert band. But it is not the kind of instrument that, you know, lends itself to large ensembles, but we do this. We do it for fun. And participation is honestly a big part of the experience. It's a very important thing for young people who are learning to play the instrument to have their special day. Matter of fact, we hear from band directors all over the region that not only is this a big deal, a privilege if you play the baritone or euphonium or tuba, getting to come to this, because you get off school too. I mean, let's not forget that part.
Uh-huh.
But that it's a special day for your instrument, and not everybody has that.
Now, when people think of tuba, I think a lot of people think of the instrument that sort of wraps around the body. But that isn't only what we're talking about here, right?
No, of
course
not.
You mentioned euphonium here.
Yeah, I did.
And that's a very different kind of tuba.
Yeah.
That's what you play, I think.
No. I play the tuba.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah.
The tuba.
But there's really two general instruments that are in this event. It is the baritone or euphonium, which is sometimes called a tenor tuba. It's a small version of the large instrument.
And it then, sort of sits on your lap or on
No, you hold that.
You hold that up. Actually, yeah, hold yeah. it up. Mm-hmm. It's not too heavy.
That's right. Okay. And the tuba is, of course, a larger instrument. The instrument you were referring to is called a sousaphone. And it's exactly the same instrument. It's just wrapped differently to make it easier to deal with when a group is marching.
Now, are the Guinness people insisting that only certain kinds of horns be in the room tomorrow? Or what's the umbrella? Are euphoniums allowed?
Yes, absolutely. That's a very good question, because we had to get the criteria for the instruments approved by Guinness. So it will include baritones, euphoniums, tubas, and sousaphones. And we're going to have to account for how many of each there are tomorrow. And do a count, and there'll be very specific rules around getting the official number.
I was going to say you have to count the number of participants mm-hmm. because Guinness is going to insist on that.
That's right.
Will the Guinness representative be right alongside the counting as it takes place?
Exactly. We have numbered wristbands that everyone who participates will get an official wristband, and that will help us to get the accurate count.
So breaking a world record, this is not something that you just sort of do.
Oh, no. No, no, no. As I said, there's quite a specific set of criteria that you have to follow. And our education manager, Stephanie Brimhall, has been wonderful helping to organize all this. And she and I and other staff have been on the phone with Guinness on a regular basis to understand the criteria to get approvals. Steve, there have to be two what are called quote-unquote expert witnesses that have enough training and ability to certify, yes, that is an appropriate instrument as it enters the arena and gets the wristband to say that's a qualified instrument. And then we have to have a group of about 20 stewards who are people who will observe the world record attempt and certify that people are actually playing the instruments.
Right.
This is very specific.
You know, you explained in a very good way early on here in our conversation about the history of this event. But why the tuba? Why didn't you go for something a little sexier like the electric guitar, Frank?
Well, I think you are, making a big assumption here that the tuba is not sexy.
Oh, come on.
Oh, come on, Steve. I think there's a little tuba shaming going on here, but we'll have that conversation off air.
Yes.
I think that one of the characteristics, as a tuba player, I can say this, one of the characteristics of tuba players is that they are very friendly, convivial people who enjoy being with one another. And so the idea that you would bring together a large group of people, I mean, if you brought together, a few hundred trumpet players, they'd probably have fistfights or something.
That's right.
So we're going to have, this event and you should know, and your listeners should know, this is one of hundreds of tuba Christmas events that goes on around the country and the world every year. So these are happening all over the country and the world.
But not like here in Kansas City.
Well, I mean, come on. We're going to set the world record. I mean, we are going to do this. And I have to say that when we started doing tuba Christmas, how this began in Kansas City is that in 2008, I should say, when the symphony started hosting it.
Right.
I got a phone call one day from Harvey Phillips, the man who started Tuba Christmas, and I had known Harvey for years and really respected him. And he said, look, we're in a spot here. The group that has for years sponsored Tuba Christmas has backed out, and we have no one to sponsor Tuba Christmas. You run the symphony. You guys know how to do events. How about taking it over?
And you did.
And it was very short notice. We had a pretty small group the first year at the Lyric Theater. But let's just say that it has grown and grown. And in part, one of the reasons it's grown is because our event is really well organized and run, and people want to come back.
Again, it'll be at noon tomorrow. This attempt to set a Guinness Book of World Records, a record for most tubas in one place, right?
That's the world's largest tuba ensemble.
Noon tomorrow at Municipal Auditorium. Frank Byrne, Executive Director of the Kansas City Symphony. Good luck with your attempt tomorrow. I'm counting on you getting there, Frank.
Thanks, Steve.
It's going to be a tremendous sound. Coming up, cool stuff to do on your weekend with Brian McTavish. I remember you said, do you even need me? Is it outside my head? Tell me, am I worth it? I remember.
remember you said, do you even see me? Go find someone else instead. Tell me, am I worth it? Am I even worthy? Tell me, am I worth it?
Okay, it's time for the weekend to-do list. Brian McTavish will be your guide one more time, and welcome back. Good to have you here.
One more time?
One more time.
This is it?
No, this is not it.
Oh.
We're just, it's part of a continuing procession.
Yes, and even if this was it, not during the holidays.
Yeah.
No, we'd save that for next year, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Well, welcome back, and who do we got here?
Well, I'm going to say his name. Ready? Not his real name. He's Dutch. His real name, he was born in the Netherlands. I can't say it. I can try later. But he goes by the moniker of San Holo. Now, who might that vaguely sound like?
I don't know.
Well,
like Star Trek or something.
Well, close, close. The Walt Disney Company thought it was a little too close to Han Solo.
Oh.
Because he likes to call himself San Holo. Anyway, he is the Dutch electronic music maker with that slightly Star Wars-ish name. 8 o'clock. Get your weekend off to an early start tonight. 8 tonight at the Truman.
Wow.
It's kind of dreamy. It's totally dance-worthy. Ever since 2013, he's been online getting a lot of hits, a lot of YouTube action. His very first full-length album came out earlier this year. And what do you think his first album is called? Album numeral one. Album.
Oh. I can't. Album one.
Well, I love it because, as you know, I'm a big fan of things that tell you exactly what they are. Album one.
You're a straightforward man.
I am, and I hope to be here after today as well.
Okay.
Who's got a beard that's long and white? Santa's got a beard that's long and white. Who comes around on a special night? Santa comes around on a special night. Special night, beard that's white.
Well, it's like the holidays are coming, I gather from songs like that. Here
yes.
we go.
Yes, it's up to us to remind everyone that it's on its way. I have several Santa Claus-related things to share.
Please share.
And we'll try to get them all in. There's so many this time of year, as you know.
Yes, there are.
The first one we're going to tackle is something called Santa Rampage KC 2018. And how can you not tell the folks about that? In a nutshell, or a stocking on the mantle, it's a bunch of Santas on bicycles doing a pub crawl.
Wow.
Yeah, and it happens from 10 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon on Saturday. It's going to hit up several downtown, midtown bar-type liquor-drinking establishments. It kicks off at the filling station, which is in the neighborhood of 29th and McGee Traffic Way. Have you? Have you gone as Santa Claus by any chance?
I have not.
Okay, well, this is your chance Saturday because you can be a Santa or you can gawk at a Santa. So the Rampage of Santas will kick off at the fire station. It'll head to Brewery Imperial, then through Crown Center on the way to McCoy's Public House in Westport. Then it's time for a Santa bike procession on the Country Club Plaza.
My God!
And a final spin. You can meet them at the end. Get there about 2:30 at Spin Neapolitan Pizza, and they'll be there. Now, I got to tell you, Santa, that white beard and the anchovies, don't do it.
Yeah.
It's a bad mix.
Bad idea.
Or bring a big comb, maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, Saturday, 10 to 3, be a Santa, look at Santa's. Oh, and a couple of more things. Pet photos with Santa. Pets pose.
Stop it.
With the jolly old elf himself from 4 to 7 on Friday at, Brookside Barkering and Bath.
Wow.
That's at 118 West 63rd Street. If you pay for a digital photo of your pet with Santa.
Right.
It's $10, and it goes to feeding those who need to be fed this holiday season. And finally, Santa dives every year with penguins at the Kansas City Zoo.
He goes swimming with the penguins.
He does that for several weekends. This is
that'd
the first weekend.
That'd be a reason to become a Santa. Go swim with the penguins.
Well, yeah, I mean,
the water would be dirty, though.
It would?
Yeah, it would.
Anyway,
be.
It's 2 o'clock Saturday and Sunday at the zoo. Observe Santa mingling and swimming with penguin-type things.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 funny things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. Okay, Lewis Black is back
town. Have you ever had, you must have had Lewis on the show.
I don't know if we, I don't think we have.
Well,
we probably should.
That's something
but
to do.
But it'd be hard to get a guy like that on this show because of how he talks. sometimes.
Well, he would alter his behavior. Anyway, in lieu of actually having Lewis on, Lewis Black is, of course, he's the very, very funny and he's sort of a glorious anger management failure,
yes.
Right? His whole shtick is getting mad at things. He will be on stage at 8 o'clock Sunday at Arvis Bank Theater at the Midland. I tried to find something, as you say, his language can be a bit blue.
Challenging.
He goes on his tirade.
For public radio,
his
yes.
crazy talking, upset thing. But anyway, let's listen to Lewis muse a bit, a relatively light moment for Lewis. He's going to talk a little bit about the legalization of marijuana. He's for it in all 50 states. His thoughts.
Now, I know that some of you are thinking, hey, you know, Lewis, the reason you want it legalized is you smoke pot. And I don't. And I seriously don't. I did. And it was great. But as any kid would, you know, some kids do, I smoked too much. I smoked a ton. And then by the time I turned 25, I was smoking so much, it didn't work anymore. It didn't work. Nothing. And then I turned 35, and I quit for 10 years. A friend of mine says, you got to try it again. They've improved it.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good. Go see Lewis Black. You won't regret it. I won't regret it if you go anyway. 8 o'clock Sunday at the Midland.
That sounds kind of familiar, only with the babies crying in the background.
Yes, so everyone's welcome, even crying babies. You've hit on it. I just wanted to touch on it again. What a wonderful event. Tuba Christmas, 2 o'clock Friday at Municipal Auditorium. Go for the record and break it, guys and gals.
Don't mind the raindrops, wait till the rain stops.
What do we have here?
Okay, we have two improvisational comedy type things to do. And they're offbeat.
You're big on the comedy this week.
Well, yeah. Ha ha. Laugh it up, right? We're only here while we're here. Let's enjoy ourselves. Improv stand-up, where stand-ups do improvisational comedy based on audience suggestions. This never happens. Stand-ups write their own jokes. But in this instance, audience members will sort of set them up and be the launching pad. 8 o'clock Friday, that's in Gladstone at the Groundhog Day Theater. And then this is something I've never even heard of, Tell Us About Yourself Improv, in which improv comics riff on stories offered by audience members about their week.
Mm.
If you had a good week or a bad week, frankly, I think a bad week's funnier, but you'll be pulled on stage to talk about it, and the improvisers will do their thing at 10 o'clock Saturday night at the Improv Shop at 38th and Broadway.
That's the legendary Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. Legendary.
Thank you, my fellow.
Thanks for the good list. I appreciate it.
Person, yeah.
Tomorrow on the show, 25,000 miles of lessons from NPR host and humorist Peter Sagal. He shares the life lessons he learned through thousands of miles and hours of running. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.